Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Really glad to have you along today because we'll start by talking about a fascinating book written by Mitch Zukov. Mitchell Zukov, professor of journalism at Boston University. He's the author of Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. And it is incredible, believe me. He has several other books. One of the books is Robert Altman, The Oral Biography, one of Amazon.com's best books of 2009, and Ponzi Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend, a New York Times Editor's Choice book. So he is joining us from the WBUR studios in Boston. Mitch Zukov, are you there?
I am, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being with us today. I really enjoyed your book. It's a fascinating story. And let's start by setting the stage for this adventure story. It's May 1945. It's on an Allied base on the island of Dutch New Guinea. What was so important about that area of the Pacific at that point in the war?
Larry, it was a strategic area of the war in the Southwest Pacific because for a while the Japanese had controlled New Guinea, hoping to use it as a launching point to attack Australia immediately to the south. And then when MacArthur took the island in April of 1944, the Americans and the Allies were using it as a base from which to launch attacks north toward the Philippines and then on toward Japan. So it was strategically important, and there were tens of thousands of people, Americans, soldiers, sailors, airmen, WACs, Women's Army Corps members, who were all stationed there on the northern coast in the place called Hollandia, which was Base G. So it was a significant place in the war at the moment.
And how did you come across this story and decide to write about it?
Well, it just sort of good fortune, Larry, more than anything. I was researching another World War II story that was less interesting, frankly, and I was reading newspaper archives and came across a headline that said, "Glider Rescue in Shangri-La Delayed by Clouds." And it pulled me up short. I read a lot of newspapers and I've never seen a headline anything like it. And the story described this plane crash, survivors, Stone Age tribesmen, an attempt to get them out using gliders, all these details, and it was hiding in plain sight. The fact that the story was unknown, it just blew me away.
It blew me away to know that we haven't heard this story before, and I don't think we're giving away a big secret to say there was a plane crash. Most of the people on the flight were killed. What was interesting was that they were not flying a mission. It was actually kind of a pleasure trip, wasn't it?
Exactly. This was a joyride, frankly, and not to put too fine a point on it. But a year earlier, in 1944, after the Allies had taken New Guinea, two flyers flying over the center of this tropical island of New Guinea looked out of their cockpit, and where their map said there should be a mountain, instead was this enormous valley. 40 miles long, 7 miles wide, just verdant, beautiful, green, tropical valley surrounded by mountains. But more interesting to them, it was incredible, living there were tens of thousands of Stone Age cannibals, people for whom, you know, the world had never changed from tens of thousands of years ago. They hadn't discovered the wheel, they hadn't discovered clothing or textiles or pottery. And so everyone who was stationed there when they had a little bit of off time wanted to take one of these joyrides to this valley. No one could land in it, but to fly over it. And it soon gained this nickname of Shangri-La. The name was borrowed, as you know, from Lost Horizon, this fictional valley. And so everyone wanted to see it. So this flight that I wrote about was really just one of these opportunities for these 24 men and women to see this valley of Shangri-La.
And like Gilligan's Island, it was supposed to be a 3-hour trip.
Yes, exactly.
That went incredibly wrong.
Exactly. The Gremlin Special took off from Hollandia, and it was designed, as you said, to be a short, you know, flyover, and everybody was supposed to have fun. And a series of tragic circumstances unfolded, and a series of terrible mistakes in the cockpit. And I detail them in the book, of course.
Yeah, sure.
And tragically, the Gremlin Special plows into this jungle-covered mountain at the edge of the Shangri-La Valley.
Yeah, they didn't make it into the valley itself. They crashed on the approach to it.
That's correct.
And the topography of that area made for, in terms of a rescue and so forth, there was really some very big obstacles.
This is one of the most dense rainforests in the world, this jungle of New Guinea. And I've been there. I went there to research the book. And I can tell you firsthand, it is incredible. It is magnificently beautiful. But it helped that I was there with a guide. They were there just on their own, hurt, frightened, without supplies, in this dense mountainous rainforest. And the chances of being found were incredibly slim. Hundreds of planes had gone down in New Guinea during World War II from many different countries. And New Guinea, because this dense forest covers almost the entire island and the mountains, and then cloud cover is frequent, once a plane goes down, it almost certainly is not going to be found. And in fact, I was just reading the paper, we're still finding lost planes in New Guinea from World War II today.
Oh, well, and the sad part of this was that so many people perished, and essentially we were left with three survivors, Margaret Hastings, who was, judging from the pictures in your book, a very beautiful woman.
Yes.
Jake McCallum and Kenneth Decker, was it?
Yes. The three survivors each had a bit of a story to tell. And as you said, Larry, Margaret Hastings was this beautiful Women's Army Corporal, Army Corps Corporal from upstate New York. She was the object of the affections of many of the thousands of men who were stationed on New Guinea. But Margaret was a very feisty, independent young woman, and she had enlisted in the war hoping to sort of find herself and to test herself. She had, as she put it, never been anywhere more interesting or exciting than Atlantic City, and suddenly found herself in the middle of this jungle with some severe burns on her legs and on her hands. And she also had just lost her best friend.
Yeah.
Joining her on the flight was her friend Laura Besley, who was killed. And the second survivor was Ken Decker, who suffered a terrible head wound. In fact, when he emerged in the jungle after the crash, he had no recollection of the flight. He would never regain any. He was amnesiac. He would never know what happened and how he survived. But he had this terrible gash in his head and horrible burns on his back and legs. And the third survivor was Lieutenant John McCullum. And he was, in some ways, fortunate that physically he was uninjured, but he suffered almost an existential wound. He lost his twin brother.
Yeah.
They were the last two to board the plane, and they hoped to do everything, as they did everything else together, to see Shangri-La together. But John McCullum found a seat near the back, near the tail, next to Margaret Hastings. Robert McCullum found a seat near the front by the cockpit. And that difference was the difference between life and death. And so when John McCullum emerged in the jungle, he was truly alone for the first time in his life.
Talking today with Mitchell Zukov, who is author of Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. Published by Harper. Larry Mueller here, glad to have you listening in. You may have some questions for Mitch as we move along today. Do you have family members who served in the Pacific Theater? Did any women in your family serve during World War II? Have you heard of this story before? I would venture to say that not many people listening will have heard of the story before. Well, join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or comment there. And when you go to the page, you'll also find a way that you can connect with the book itself, because we've got it posted up on our Facebook page. Mike in West Bend has a comment or question. Let's go there. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm going to read this book. It's fascinating. I don't want to take up too much of your time. My dad was a combat photographer in New Guinea, And wow. Most people don't realize that Lugini was fought mostly in the Owen Stanley Mountains. And there's a wonderful book out, just came out. It's called The Green Mountain Boys. And
yes.
All of the guys that occupied Lugini, they're from Wisconsin and Michigan. It's the 32nd. It's the National yeah. Guard and the draftees. And my dad would tell me stories. And at 45, Lugini finally killed him. But he would tell me stories of the porters. In fact, he said that they decided that the Japanese weren't as kind to them as the Americans, and they had to make decisions. But my dad says that these guys were Stone Age men, but they would make them carry they would porter for them and carry all of this ammunition and whatever they could get up into the mountains. And my dad would tell me how diverse New Guinea was. It would be literally, men are dying of hypothermia in the mountains and the heat. And it was just an incredible, that book, Green Mountain Boys, describes what they went through.
I actually interviewed the author of that book.
Oh, fabulous book. And I donated my dad's photos to the 32nd for their museum, but I kept a photo of, I have that photo that's in the book, and I tried to get a hold of the author because I believe my dad took that photo. That's with this wounded soldier being carried out by porters. But,
well, I think.
Fascinating country.
It is a fascinating country, and I think Mitch is describing pretty well the conditions in that country.
Thank you, Mike.
It was tough to get around.
It really was, and I think Mike also brings up a point through his comment that a lot of the stories of New Guinea and of the Southwest Pacific have not been well enough told yet, and they're still being told, whether in the other books or in my book. We've focused, understandably, a tremendous amount of attention on Europe, but I think to some extent the South Pacific and the Southwest Pacific have been overlooked. And so it's great to get these stories out, especially while the veterans are still around, while they can still tell their stories and share them with us, because they're enormously important.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mike, for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Lynn and Eau Claire a chance to join us. Lynn, hello to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Mitch. I had a great aunt that I never got the pleasure to meet. Her plane went down. She was a nurse in World War II. Plane went down in the Sea of Japan. There was a sole survivor. It was the gentleman who traded seats with her. And it's been 60 years, and within the last 6 years, they erected a tombstone for her in Arlington.
So,
thank you for this. This is really, it's heartbreaking. It's interesting.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, Lynn. I have to tell you, the WAC groups and the nurses groups have been enormously active, and they were enormously helpful to me in telling these stories that I think this first generation there were, of course, nurses serving in the military going back, many, many decades, but World War II was a watershed moment for women serving in the military, and it proved that they could do enormously important tasks. And I think the current generation of women who we have serving the armed forces owe them a debt of gratitude for having paved the way.
They risked their lives, and many, as you point out in your book, lost their lives serving in as WACs in World War II.
Yes.
Thank you again, Lynn, very much. And let's go to Dirk in Milwaukee. Dirk, hello to you.
Good afternoon. There was a rather sensationalist movie called The Sky Above, The Mud Below. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It pretty much duplicates this. It was kind of a pseudo-documentary. I'm wondering if you're familiar with it at all.
I'm not. No, I'm sorry, Dirk. Maybe I'm a little happy to hear I'm not familiar with it. If it was sensationalized and... because my goal and the way I told Lost in Shangri-La was to tell it strict nonfiction. These stories are too important, and they're too great to want to layer on falsehoods and sensationalize. So I don't know the movie.
And I do want to talk with you about how you put this book together. It's meticulous. I wanted to bring up the caller Paul wanted to correct the name of the book the previous caller mentioned, and I should have caught that myself. It wasn't the Green Mountain Boys. It was the Ghost Mountain Boys. That was the name of that.
Yes.
The Ghost Mountain Boys. I should have Should have remembered that myself. Mitchell Zukov, our guest today, author of Lost in Shangri-La. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with author Mitchell Zukov about his book, Lost in Shangri-La, published by Harper. Great to have him along, and thank you so much for listening in. Again, you can join us with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And before we go to Scott in La Crosse, hang on there, Scott. I mentioned that I wanted to ask Mitch about the research he did for this book, and it was you did a wonderful job. I mean, man, talk about a thorough look at this whole event, and you had access to some great sources as well.
I was incredibly fortunate, Larry. The most key source early on was Earl Walter. Well, when the survivors were finally spotted, the Army knew they couldn't get them out, but they knew they had to get somebody in to protect them. And they turned to this guy, Captain Earl Walter, who was the leader of a paratroop team of Filipino-American soldiers. And Earl just turned 90 a few weeks ago. He's become a friend. He turned over to me photographs that he took while he was in the Valley of Shangri-La, the logbook, the daily journal that he kept while he was there. And he just spent hours and hours with me telling the story. And so, and then he connected me with some other people. So that was an enormously important human source. And then I was fortunate enough to find that the survivor, the female survivor, Margaret Hastings, had left a diary. And it had been preserved, sort of preserved in amber almost, in a little historical society in upstate New York. And so one piece after another, it was sort of pulling together pieces of string and weaving them together, and then going to New Guinea to research the other side of the story, to go and meet people who had been children, natives who had been children when all this happened, and get their perspective of what happened almost like the day the Martians landed in their yeah. world.
Yeah, it's great, great detail, and it is very fascinating. Scott in La Crosse has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Larry. It sounds like a wonderful book. My question is this. I'm assuming we're dealing here with a C-47 or something of that ilk flying with the flag of the United States under the auspices of the U.S. Army Air Corps, right?
That's correct. It was a C-47.
How do you justify this as a non-military mission? I mean, how do they get away? Do they have to cover up a joyride, or how do they deal with that?
It's a great question, Scott. What they did was, well, these kinds of flights, first, I believe, still take place today. I was talking to a pilot just last week who had been in Iraq, and they call today, I believe, they call them incentive flights, sort of reward flights for performance. Back then, they did cover it up, frankly. It was listed on I got a ream of declassified Army documents, Army Air Corps documents, and they listed it as a navigational training flight. Which, of course, sounds a lot better than this day happened to have been Mother's Day. So I guess the alternative was Mother's Day Joyride, which wouldn't have looked nearly as good on the logbook. But Scott, you're absolutely right. But at the same time, I think we sort of accept that people who have R&R, who are serving, they're working 7 days a week, serving the military, part of the war effort. They do need some relaxation, and this was a morale building flight, so I think that's how it was justified.
Yeah. Thank you for calling, Scott. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. And I guess it should be noted, it must have been hard for you to talk to the son of the pilot. I believe you talked with the son.
Yes. Yes.
Of the pilot, because there was a huge pilot error there.
Exactly. And Larry, this was maybe the hardest part of the entire process. I found Peter Prossen Jr. and his father, Peter Sr., was in fact both the organizer and the pilot of the Gremlin Special that day. And through witness statements and a variety of other means, it was clear what had happened. And one of the major reasons for the crash was that Peter Prossen, who was an excellent pilot and a very experienced colonel, left the cockpit at a key moment as they were entering this very treacherous part of the flight, flying through a mountain pass into a side valley on the way into the main valley of Shangri-La. And he left to socialize with the WACs and the soldiers and the officers who were in the cabin. And he left behind a much less experienced major who was his co-pilot. And so the pilot had a series of errors. There was probably a downdraft as well. But the absence of Peter Prossen was a major cause of this crash. And it became clear to me while I was talking to his son about him, I wanted to get to know who Peter Prossen was, that his son, who was at that point in his 70s, he was a boy when his father died in 1945, he did not know that his father had left the cockpit. And it was a very difficult conversation, but Peter Jr., for whom I have great respect, accepted the information. He wanted to know how I put it all together, and I explained it to him. And he said simply, that was not a good thing to have done.
Yeah.
And it was a very difficult moment.
Can we talk about a little bit more about the survivors of the crash and sort of what happened to them as they were sort of awaiting rescue? And it took some very fortunate for them positive action by moving away from the crash site.
Exactly. If you ever have, this is what I've decided, if you ever have the misfortune of being in a plane crash on a jungle mountain, you want to have the good fortune of having someone or finding someone like this in yourself, like John McCollum. He had just lost his brother, and yet he led these other two survivors down through the jungle to a clearing that he had spotted from a tree. He was stoic. He was brave. He accepted that he had to lead them, and it's really in many ways a story of leadership and resilience, I think. And so he led them through the jungle down an icy stream to this clearing, where they very soon after encountered some of these Stone Age cannibals that they had hoped to see only from the air. And so then while they were waiting there, they were fortunate enough to be spotted from the air, just as John McCollum had hoped they would be. But then they had to deal with these cannibals.
Yeah. And and that whole relationship was really, really fascinating. And the backstory, one of the things that I liked about your book was the fact that you went into some detail on, I don't know if that would be a side story, but you had several sort of backgrounding parts to the book that I really liked, and one was one part of it I really was interested in was the backstory on these natives who were there.
You know, it was very important to me, Larry, not to treat the natives as one or even two-dimensional characters. These people had a very real culture, and they still have a very real culture. They're now known as the Dani tribe of New Guinea, and their area is the Balium Valley, for those of you who know New Guinea. And I didn't want to treat them the way we used to treat Native Americans in old 1930s Westerns.
Like, yeah.
You know, just, you know, with no real language, no real motivation, no culture. And so when I went and did my research on them, I found they had a fascinating culture.
Yeah.
They're a tribe of warriors who fought wars endlessly, and who were, you know, had very rich beliefs. And very fortunately for me, when I talked to these people, they could explain to me what they thought was happening when these people came into their valley. And they related it to part of their culture. They had a legend called the Uluwayek prophecy. And Uluwayek predicted that someday light-skinned ghosts or spirits would come down a rope from the sky. And they thought these survivors and then these paratroopers who truly came down a rope from the sky, if you think about a parachute, were the fulfillment of this prophecy. And so it was important to me to try to give that kind of three-dimensional portrait and not just focus on the one-dimensional people or the place.
Jeff in Madison, we give you a chance now. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
Yes, just a little more on that previous caller mentioned the sky in the mud. It was a French, it wasn't a sensationalist movie at all. It was a French documentary called Le Ciel et la Boue, which took place in the 50s or early 60s, I think it came out. I saw it in New York years ago, and it is a black and white, astonishing documentary of a French expedition into the heart of uncharted Papua New Guinea. It was literally just white area on a map when they went in. And it documents a first encounter between the French explorers and Papuans who had never seen outsiders before. And it's one of the most amazing documentaries of, or it's the only documentary of first encounter I've ever seen. The people are absolutely three-dimensional. They come up. They are curious. They are astounded at some, both sides are astounded at both sides. The French explorers almost starved to death. A couple of their porters died in crossing rivers. This is all on film, and they almost starved to death. They'd run out of food, and at whoever was at their base camp in Port Moresby was trying to kept sending up a small, I think, twin otter to do a food drop, but the clouds were so thick, could never get through. Finally, it shows on film the plane actually coming through. There was a hole in the clouds, and managed to do a food drop out of it. And the Papuans were absolutely shocked to see this giant bird fly over and food drop out of it, and these French people go over and start to rip it apart and eat it. They just looked at it like they were appalled. But, I mean, it is an incredible, it's not sensationalist at all. It's an incredible documentary of the sort of encounter you're describing.
Thank you, Jeff. I will absolutely look for that film. One other film I would love to point people's attention toward, it was actually, if you're describing from the Port Moresby area, this was a different part of New Guinea, although so much of New Guinea in the 40s and 50s and even back to the 30s was the subject of these kinds of first encounters. There's an amazing documentary film by a Harvard documentarian named Robert Gardner, and his film is called Dead Birds, which actually focuses on the tribe of people who I'm writing about, the Dani people. And maybe in your anthropology classes from college, some of you may have seen Dead Birds, but if you haven't, it's a remarkable, remarkable piece of work.
Thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And Bill in Oshkosh, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. Interesting show. Very. Can't wait to read the book, and a couple things I might say will show that ignorance, but there is some other literature for readers. I think a guy by the name of Eric Bodgerup, who's a historian at a college on the West Coast, has written two or three books about the war in the Solomons and New Guinea, which are first-rate, and also one called Fire in the Sky about the air war. But the ground war with the American Marines in Guadalcanal and soldiers of the 32nd at Buna and places like that is extraordinary, I think. The other thing is there is, Gardner did his film in the early 60s, I believe.
That's correct.
And, you know, I kind of object to the somewhat sensational notion that the people were cannibals. I'm not sure about the Dani, but the Central Highlands people that I worked with in the same kind of country in the Waigie Valley to the east of the Balim were not cannibals, as far as we know. The missionaries said we didn't know how to ask questions, but it was kind of humorous. But the as far as we can tell, there wasn't any at all. There was some in the fringes of the highlands on the plateau of southern New Guinea, the Savi Plateau. There definitely was, and there's some connection, people think, between diet, which in the central valleys was actually very, very good, with sweet potatoes and a number of other things. There were diseases, but generally starvation wasn't a problem. But you said where they crashed was on the side over the range from the Balim Valley, and if they then went directly toward the ocean, toward a clearing, they would have been with people that might have been less particular about, and I don't know that country, so I don't know if they were cannibals or not, but it's become quite a modern country now. I don't know. The Dutch have worked in what is now known as West Irian or West New Guinea, and they're more up on the state of development. But the east side is quite developed in many ways. And with the people there, when the first patrol came in 1934, were quite astounded by the same myth, actually, that these people were there. But when they found out by watching the policemen, who were a little familiar with some of the ladies and where the men went to do their toilet, that they were really, in fact, human, they were a little tougher. But and some of the groups tried to shoot them up on their way home, but to get at their cargo inside. So they were, I've worked with the people, they're very nice now, but they could be, on occasion, very difficult. And your point about food is true. The patrols that went into the highlands of New Guinea were often, from the south, were often lost carriers and their own because of starvation. And the problem, the New Guinea highlands, except for the Wagyi, as far as I know, and this other expedition you're speaking of, well, in the Balim, they were very hard to get people there because from the south, because they had to carry all their food, and there's only so far you can go with a set of carriers with the food you can carry.
Well, Bill, I appreciate it. I do want to point out, in terms of the cannibalism, I have no reason to doubt. I don't know what was happening in other parts, but I do know for a fact that there was cannibalism in the Balim. And in fact, some of the people who I spoke to, who were old men and women when I went there, described the practice to me quite vividly. And there's a very well-respected book called Cannibal Valley, pardon me, by Russell Hitt, in which he describes and photographs the butchering of an enemy warrior, a fallen warrior, for a cannibal feast, as he describes it. So, yes, I agree that to some extent, stories of cannibalism, as you can, I guess, imagine, can be easily inflated and turned into something they're not. But, in fact, the people of the Dani and the Yali tribe of the Balium Valleys did practice cannibalism.
And this was, I want to make it clear, too, that this is a very large population in this 40-mile-long, 7-mile-wide area.
Yes. We're talking about tens of thousands of people living in these thatched-roofed huts in these little villages or hamlets, if you will. And so certainly they had different practices. But, yeah, we're talking about a remarkable number of people who certainly until the 30s and into the 40s were simply unknown. It was like coming across Kansas City, Missouri. And you know, at that time, a similar population, and saying, my God, how is this here? And we didn't know about it.
And I think after that initial shock on both sides when they met, there were some deeper relationships that grew. I think the relationship between the Dani chief that they had nicknamed Pete, also let's see, the queen, and as they called it, Margaret.
Yes.
Those were some deep relationships.
You know, the fellow they called Pete, I learned his real name was Wimayuk Wandik, and I met his son, Helenma Wandik, while I was there. And he was a very thoughtful, decent leader, Wimayuk Wandik was. And he was the one who first said, no, these are spirits. We should not kill them. And he took it upon himself to look after Margaret and Decker in particular because of their injuries. And there's a moment that Margaret never understood. She wrote about it in her diary. And it was when they first were together with Wimayuk Wandik in this jungle clearing. And he was blowing on the wound of Decker, on the head wound of Decker. And he was blowing his breath onto it. And Margaret made a kind of a little bit of a joke that, oh, his breath was awful. And what she didn't realize was that Wimayuk Wandik was trying to heal Decker's soul. The idea that his soul was in danger, that he was in danger of dying, and his soul was not in the right place. And so this was really a remarkable coming together of two cultures. Even if they didn't understand each other at the time, in retrospect, we can look back and say this is a first encounter that did not go as the Hollywood folks would have scripted, perhaps with cannibalism or that sort of thing, but of with understanding and togetherness.
Absolutely. I'm wondering, and I don't want to give away all of the story here, but I'm wondering how there was such a media circus surrounding this once they were found, and there's great story about the actually dropping another person in there to film some of this and the fact that there were essentially press conferences in the air.
Yes.
But I'm wondering how all of this affected the Donnie and, you know, sort of the aftermath.
I think not in a great way, frankly, Larry. After this all happened, although the story sort of disappeared for decades, there were people who were watching it at the time, and it did lead to, after the war, missionaries in the 1950s coming in and a tremendous amount of attention being paid to the Donnie people. And I think it's a worthy question for argument whether this improved or destroyed their lifestyle. Well, certainly it ended the wars that were costing them lives and costing them some of their young warriors and some of their other people. The current state of life in the Balyam Valley is not a good one. It is a very impoverished part. It's now this western part of the New Guinea is now part of Indonesia, and it's a particularly poor province of Indonesia, which is really saying something. And so it did affect them, and I'm not sure it was much for the good. But if we can go back a second, I know. I don't want to give it away either, but I just can't stop talking about the way the army decided to try to get them out of there.
That's amazing.
Without telling if it worked, people should know that this was the plan, that the idea was because we can't land a plane in there, we can't march them out, we can't get a helicopter in, we're gonna drop materials to them to erect imagine a rough football goalpost, and then we're going to have them string a giant rubber band off the top of that goalpost and attach the other end of the rubber band to the nose of a glider that we drop into this remote valley. And then we're going to have other C-47s, other planes, sweep down low into the valley with hooks hanging off their bellies to snatch that rubber band off the top of that goalpost and pull that glider, loaded with people now, up and over these surrounding mountains. Now, this is a rescue plan that seems designed to increase the casualties.
It is such a wonderful story. Will this be a movie or?
We hope so. The talks are underway.
I'm telling you, Mitch, it is a fascinating read, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Larry. It was great.
Mitchell Zukov is the author of Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. And I'm telling you, it's an adventure book, but it's true. Everything in here actually happened, and it is well documented by Mitch Zukov. And his last name is spelled, by the way, it's pronounced Zukov, but it's spelled Z-U-C-K-O-F-F. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you'll find a way to take another look at the book and also, of course, a way to order the book. And while you're there, you can also take a look at another book that we're going to be talking about next. The title of that book is Cluck, From Jungle Fowl to City Chicks. And we have the author and the artist with me in the studio. That's next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.